This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
So apparently, a lot of people think Patrick Clancy is the one who actually took the lives of the children and somehow magically she's been covering for him for 3 years. And I don't know. We're going to talk about it today. And I welcome your thoughts and your comments in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we go through this, Facebook, wherever you're watching. I'm going to watch them. And if you got a comment, if you got something that you think like, this can't be debunked, or here's, throw it in there. Throw it in there, because that's what I want to do. I want to discuss. I want to hear you out, because, you know, there's stranger things have happened. And in no way, shape, or form am I saying that I think Patrick Clancy has anything to do with this. But I'm trying to understand why this is becoming a thing, why we're even talking about this. But a lot of people are. So hence, we are going to as well and address some of the comments that we've been seeing that you guys have. Some of the look, with anything, There's misinformation that gets out and people think it's fact, and then they start applying it to their theories and going, see, well, your theory doesn't work if your facts aren't based on reality. Lindsay Clancy is on trial at Plymouth Superior Court for the deaths of her three children, and her own attorney told the jury that she killed them. She has said it as well. The fight in that courtroom is over her mind, not her hands. But online, a growing crowd has decided the real killer is actually her husband, Patrick Clancy. He staged it. He framed his wife and walked away to a new life. Robin Drake obviously is with us, as he always is. Welcome back from a few days off.
Yes,
retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. People got smarter since you've been gone.
Probably.
Oh, wait. No, they haven't. It's gotten worse. where does this instinct come from? I mean, Robin, you've been seeing it, in the last couple of days online. Why is the internet, before we dive into some of the specific arms and tentacles of this, why do you think this is something that's gaining traction and people are going after Patrick Clancy?
So I think it's pretty simple, actually. If you've been watching the trial, and a lot of these theories, I think, are coming up because of the people watching a trial, she's a compelling figure in the courtroom. I mean, we said it from the very beginning. She's not performative. She's collapsing onto herself with the vast emotion she has of the remorse, the supreme guilt, her lack of even will to live because of the heinous act she's admitted to doing, killing her three kids. And then you see the people standing with her in the courtroom, basically everyone standing with her, except her psychiatrist, who's getting railed by Reddington right now.
Being civilly sued as well, who has a vested interest.
That's a whole separate story I know we'll talk about.
Yeah,
I've been watching that all morning.
Yes, yes. So
anyway, what happens in the brain, because I thought a lot about this over the weekend too, what happens in the brain, and with all of us, we want there to be a simple explanation. And when you can no longer, because I think most of these people are now placing the blame on Patrick, or originally placing the blame on her, and not taking into really account what a psychosis and a psychotic break can actually look like long term, mm-hmm. short term. And that's what this whole trial is really about. It's the mental health and the psychotic break. And if you can't imagine this woman doing it because of what you're seeing in the courtroom, because of the testimony you're seeing, you have to find the monster somewhere. And so who deviates from the norm of what we visually see in that courtroom? We see Patrick with very little affect, very, very detail-oriented, very much in knowing of what's going on. He's got depth of field of his ex-wife, the medications and everything going on. And so when we as a mass see all these people in her circle so close like this, and then we see someone who got married 3 years after, moved to Manhattan, stand by her side. And in other words, our brain wants to find the villain in this. Since we're no longer willing to put the villainous on her, we're going to put it on someone rather than an institution or the psychosis itself. And so I think that's a reason why this is happening.
it's filling in the blank, basically.
Yeah.
Our brain is searching for the blank.
Yes.
Because we're basically walking Mad Libs.
and once we get an idea of what we think it is, well, then we're going to now find facts, data, and details with our confirmation bias and our amazing skill set of finding patterns where real patterns don't really exist to support our conclusion that we've now concluded. People have said this all. I don't like the way he looks. He does not have an interaction what he should be having. He got married too fast. He must be guilty. Now we're going to start looking at facts, data, and details to support the conclusion we've come to, as well as it makes us more susceptible to the world of TikTok, social media, and all these other conjectures and thought experiments that are people twisting around, which aren't based on facts, data, and details, because they dismissed it and dismissed him because alibi, time, motive, I mean, everything was dismissed rapidly on that. Plus, if you watch Reddington for 5 minutes, do you really think anything would slip by him, or anything one would slip by any of these people? So again, the laws of probability, and you opened up with stranger things have happened. Not that often.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, it's just, I when I first heard this, I thought, well, this is really fringe. And then it's like, it's not so fringe. There's a lot of people believing this.
Sure.
And my wife brought it up to me the other day, because she's not really following this very closely, but she saw a TikTok about it, and she's like, have you heard this one? And I'm like, yeah. And I immediately am just like, it's bullshit, whatever, you know? And then she started talking about it more, and I'm like, okay, what are you hearing? You know, it's as someone who's just kind of passively taking this in. And I'm trying to understand, it's not that she believes it, but it was like, what's registering here that's intriguing you? Because it's an intriguing thought, and it's pulling people in. But a lot of it, because she sent me like one of the laundry lists that are out there of here's everybody's theory, and it wasn't her list, it was somebody that came up with it. And immediately you go to it, and it's filled with mistruths or just lies or not things that are not factual. Like one of the first things I saw in there is he got remarried within 4 months. No, he didn't. It was 3 years. Mm-hmm. 3 years.
Confirmed it this past April.
Like
April 2026.
What is wrong with that? I mean, even that people are like, that's too soon.
No,
3 years is a long period of time.
And also, I mean, believe it or not, you know, me and my stats, you know, because I always start with stats and research, and then we see how it fits a pattern of behavior or not fits a pattern of behavior. And so, yeah, getting married within 3 years of a traumatic event like this and losing three children, it is rapid. So
it is.
It is actually, it is rapid, but it actually falls within a trauma response for healing. So so the affect we're typically seeing is, I did the research on this too. You know, when you hear, we only saw the text and transcription of the 911 call and what his response was from first respondent when they showed up, and his massive emotional response of, she fucking killed the kids. I mean, it was, you know,
I'd probably say the same thing. And it's not like you're saying it like, and fuck so the when, kids. You're saying, she killed the fucking kid. I mean, that's not even the actual testimony. That was actually the internet that added that to it.
Right. And so what you're seeing, though, is when you see him in the courtroom, he's deviating from what we're seeing from everyone else in the emotional response. But what you're seeing him, though, is you're seeing, most likely, not a licensed clinician here, you're seeing his trauma response to trying to compartmentalize the loss he's been through.
Yeah.
So you're not seeing the same. He's got roadblocks up. He's got psychological blocks up because he can't face that horror every day. Yeah. And that's also a reason why some people get married that soon after. Granted, 3 years is not a huge amount of time, but it's also not a super short amount of time either. It's on the low end of recovering from this, but the desire for him to move on and move forward is what fuels those. Again, pure conjecture, but it doesn't fall so out of the norm that people say it must be him.
To me, it's like, what are we basing this on? Number one, to me, like 3 years seems like a pretty fair amount of time to have found someone that's helping you heal, because inevitably you're going to need somebody that can help you with that process for the rest of your life after going through something like that. And it's not unreasonable to think that within 3 years, you might have come across someone that may fit that bill, and that you may develop a relationship within 3 years that turns into somebody and something that you want to spend the rest of your life with. I don't, like, that does not register. 4 months, I'd be a little bit like, this is probably not healthy. You know, I don't know that you're, but everybody heals differently. There's a lot of people that have spouses that die or something traumatic happens. And it actually, and I'm not saying it's good, but they do move on to somebody else quickly because they almost, they fall into that, the arms of someone else, if you will, you know, when there's a trauma bond that begins and then they start, you know, healthy, sure. Not healthy. You look at however you want. But 3 years seems pretty normal to me. It doesn't seem like it's out of bounds. And I just don't understand where people are coming from going, that's way too quick. Number one, who the hell out there has been in this situation? I don't think most anyone exactly like this, like nobody. I mean, it's 1 in 1,000 women that this even happens to. So to break this down to this level, your scope of people that can comparatively say, well, here's how I handled it, or here's how I would handle it, is like slim to none. And I just, even looking at it from an outsider in, I don't know, it doesn't register to me as weird.
Well, it's also the connection between Manhattan, his trip to Manhattan prior to this incident happening, and then her being Manhattan and moving. So I think it's the Manhattan connection too, which was, it again, they don't go into details, but he did not apparently meet her until after the murders of three children, but he did do a trip to Manhattan. She's a lawyer in Manhattan. So yeah, the possibility of meeting her on a trip he took at some point later. Yeah. It's just time and place, but people are screwing with the timeline of actually when they met to fit the narrative they want it to be.
That's exactly what's happening. Like, he went to Manhattan before, so he must have had, or he was doing business in Manhattan because he's living in Massachusetts.
But the whole thing that undermines that as well is when you look at the arc of their, because again, I when these things pop up, I deep dive them. I never ever dismiss any theories that come out there because you never know. Like you said, stranger things have happened. But when you do the deep dive, and the deep dive I always do is relationships. I do healthy relationships. I'm looking for the healthy signs of relationships. I'm looking for periods of gaps of time where there can be a lack of transparency. I'm looking for the transparency between these two. I'm looking for depth of field they had in each other's lives. I'm looking at what the people around them are saying about the relationship, what they're saying about themselves. Mm-hmm. Because inevitably, in every case we've covered, in every life I follow in life, if there's an issue, there's going to be a leak, there's going to be a wobble, and those things are those little puffs of smoke that might be fire or red flag that goes up, and then you do a deep dive. So far, I have not seen, and we have not been privy to, any red flags at all between the relationship, as reported by the people in her life, Lindsay's good friends, both sets of parents, as well as the daycare provider for the kids that came in. She testified. I mean, it's just non-existent.
Well, the biggest elephant in the room on this theory, I mean, I can break down. I mean, the timeline doesn't make any sense as to what they're saying, like how he would have staged this. It just doesn't add up. Like, so the conspiracy,
it's a lot of work.
I'm not even going to entertain it or try to break it because it just doesn't work. The conspiracy timeline is bullshit. It doesn't work. But the biggest elephant in the room to me is just the fact that Lindsay Clancy, it would still be covering for him to this day in that courtroom, has convinced an attorney as well to cover for him. And she's again, there's just, like, I just, this just doesn't work in any way, shape or form to make sense.
Or that he must have been a pharmaceutical mastermind in order to blank her mind out. In other words, he had the Men in Black pen to blank her mind out.
And the toxicology, she was, I mean, yes, a psychotic state is different than being over-medicated or toxicity of medication.
Or not remembering.
And she wasn't in a toxic state of medication. That's not to say the medications weren't working well or interacting incorrectly. You don't have to overdose on the medication. There's so much misunderstanding in this case of what these things even mean. Mm-hmm. People think that, well, the medication wasn't working, that she was overdosing, she wasn't taking it, or she wasn't taking enough of it. Or, I mean, it's just like, people, drugs interact differently, and SSRIs and all these different types of meds that she was on, antipsychotics, benzodiazepines, you name it, they interact differently. There's half-lives. You get on it. It takes time to get on for it to even work, and then to get off, even if it's not working. The way she was going on and off of 30 of these now in the course of 4 months is the most current crazy number. That no one should be prescribing that, no matter what. There's no human being on this planet that should be going on and off of 30 of these medications in 4 months, or what the more condensed version is 13 in like 3 weeks or something.
And as you listen to the psychiatrist Tufts this morning on Cross from Reddington, again, as of the recording of this, her depth of field and knowledge of the impact of what these medications on Lindsay would have been is actually minimal. She had only been a fully licensed on her own psychiatrist for 1 month prior to taking Lindsay as a client. And she had been in residency for a couple years. But you know, this is what Reddington really was hammering on, is she had been a fully licensed, able to medicate without the supervision of another physician for 1 month prior to taking on Lindsay as a client, and had only roughly a small number of people as a fully licensed. Granted, she said she saw about 40 or 50 people with postpartum depression during her time of being a resident, but never ever had handled anyone with psychotic break. And also Reddington also highlighted, I can't remember the name of the assessment, we'll have to definitely ask
Siobhan,
because she's been covering everything so closely on this. She didn't even provide one of the postpartum assessments that is a standard that a lot of doctors give, a lot of psychiatrists give. Her depth of field, and the big thing was, and I know we're talking about the husband on this one, but she had never seen Lindsay she met Patrick once. This is the psychiatrist Tufts, and she had never met Lindsay in person until court. Everything was teleconference. Everything. And so she's primarily there as a psychiatrist for the medication issues that she had to deal with. And she provided up to 9 to 15 minutes tops of counseling during these sessions that she actually had Lindsay in. And when pressed by Reddington, what kind of therapy did you provide? Well, I validated her. I said, there's hope. I made her feel better. And he says, exactly how? And she couldn't answer. So it was really highlighting that issue. So when you see the wobbles in the care she was given clinically, it really, that on top of the fact that timelines don't light up on Patrick, kind of doing my full circle back here, it's just kind of ludicrous. You can see very evident. And that's why I've really encouraged people to watch, you know, the clips.
Yeah.
They're covering it very, very well on Court TV and other places as well. You can just do it by section if you just want to watch, you know, one of these people under testimony. It's been very interesting and very good, very educational.
We've been putting up the audio of the testimony every single day on on the podcast. So if you want to get that, go to wherever you get podcasts and search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, and you will find the podcast audio. It's maddening. It really is
predictable. Maddening. Well, it happens every time. It does. Unfortunately, I think it just says more about the people that do that and then propagate misinformation without that, and that's not our audience, which is really great, because you know on here we focus on critical thinking, we entertain all thoughts, we live in the world of maybe, and then we explore everything by let's look at facts, data, detail, probabilities, and then relationships involved, see life arcs, we see behavior arcs, we assess everyone involved with each other, and we come up with very reasonable, pragmatic, easy conclusions, because everything dealing with every single case really does boil down to horrendous things don't get all that complicated when you really boil it down to the grassroots of what happened. Because the more complex you make something, or a hypothesis you make it, or a conspiracy theory, the more complex it is, the less likely it is to have happened. Because people can't keep their mouths shut.
It's a lot of hoops to jump through on this one to make that one work.
But
your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. I welcome it.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
At 4:13 in the afternoon on January 24th of 23, Lindsay Clancy opened Apple Maps and measured the drive from her house in Duxbury to a restaurant in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Assistant District Attorney Jennifer Sprague told the jury what that measurement was for. Sprague said Clancy wanted to know how long someone would be gone if they ran that errand. 11 minutes before the map search, she had looked up Children's Miralax. At 4:47, she called the CVS in Kingston herself and asked the manager if they had it. At 5:15, she texted her husband and asked him to pick up Pedialax for Cora, plus dinner on the way home. She hadn't cooked anything, she wrote, and it had been a long day. He left, and a store camera caught him on in the children's medicine aisle at 5:32. Online, that errand is the alibi. Patrick Clancy built it for himself. Ooh. On the Commonwealth timeline, he's running in 62 minutes after his wife timed it. One's an alibi. One is the errand. Patrick Clancy has never been charged with anything. No prosecutor has named him. No detective has named him. And his wife's own lawyer told the jury that she killed their children. So has she. 18 jurors have heard every fact this theory rests on under oath. And not one of them has been asked to consider him. This theory that Patrick Clancy is somehow the one that caused all of this lives on Instagram and TikTok. You know, the bastions of truth. The bastions of truth, transparency, and honesty that Instagram and TikTok have always been. Accounts run it under headlines like Lindsay didn't trust Patrick anymore, but why? And Patrick wasn't a husband. He was a fourth child. Single posts pull hundreds of thousands of views. Some pull millions. The claim goes like this. And depending on who you talk to, some people have different variations. Patrick drugged his wife for months, killed the children himself, staged her injuries to look self-inflicted, and built an alibi at a pharmacy counter. That's essentially how it goes. Nobody with the power to subpoena a phone record has ever said it. The Plymouth County District Attorney charged one person with these deaths, and the Massachusetts State Police investigated and named that same person. Kevin Reddington is one of the most aggressive defense lawyers in Massachusetts. In his opening statements, he conceded that his client is the one who did it. She did. He also told the jury she had no motive because she loved them. The only question in front of that jury is whether Lindsay Clancy was criminally responsible, which means whether her mind was working well enough to hold her to account. If the jury says it wasn't, she doesn't walk out of anything. She goes to a state psychiatric hospital and comes up for review. Judge William Sullivan asked her on August 4th whether she understood what she was signing, and she answered him out loud more than once that she did. By signing it, she agreed the Commonwealth would not have to prove certain forensic facts about blood, bands, and the DNA. She says, "I did it." We have not been contesting the government's case in chief, Reddington told the court. Angela Krause manages the CVS in Kingston, and she was on the witness stand for about 5 minutes. Lindsay Clancy called that store herself and asked whether the medication was in stock. Krause testified her voice wasn't slurred or impaired in any way, and she called it a very normal interaction. Krause never spoke to Patrick inside the store. What she handed police was his receipt. Sarah Shelgin works as a hostess at 3V in Plymouth. She testified that Lindsay Clancy placed the takeout order herself and that she had no trouble understanding her. She said there was nothing out of the ordinary about the man who came to pick it up. The defense cross-examined neither woman. The phone log covers the rest of it. At 5:33, Patrick called Lindsay and got no answer. At 5:34, she called him back and approved a generic brand. And that call lasted 14 seconds. He checked out 3 minutes later and reached the restaurant at 5:54. Patrick testified the drive home from there ran about 10 or 12 minutes. He was back inside his own house at 6:09. And 2 minutes after that, he was screaming into the 911 line. All of that is factual. All of that can be backed up with cameras, timestamps, digital devices. It's all there. None of it is in question. Two women working their shifts that afternoon heard her voice and described someone in complete control of what she was doing. A store camera and phone company put her husband exactly where he said he was. Four psychiatric medications showed up in her blood that night. They were Miazepram, Lamotrigine, Trazodone, and Quantapine. I might have screwed up two of those names. Every one of them had been prescribed to her by a doctor, not fed to her by her husband. Justin Brower is a forensic toxicologist, which means he measures drug levels in blood and testifies about what those levels do to a body. He told the jury the amounts came in within therapeutic range and some of them fell below it. So he wasn't over-medicating her, as the theory goes. Only one drug registered as elevated at all, Quantapine, sold under the name Seroquel, sat roughly 10 times under the concentration a toxicologist would call toxic. A prosecutor asked whether those levels could have stopped a person from breathing. Barry said not necessarily, that we'd want more information about her overall condition. Then he told the jury what an overdose looks like from a lab bench. People take handfuls of pills when they're trying to end their lives, he testified. And this was not consistent with that. And it wasn't consistent with somebody trying to poison her or over-medicate her either. Brower was careful about the limits of his own field, and he said toxicology doesn't tell the entire story. That caveat belongs in the record. The theory needs her sedated by someone else. The lab found her own prescriptions at the doses her doctors had written. Prosecutors have a different sequence for the pills. They allege she crushed and swallowed some of her medication after the children were dead. Patrick Clancy came home to a silent house. He called his wife's phone and nobody picked up. He went to the second floor and found the door to his own bedroom locked. That's when I knew something was wrong, he testified. He unlocked it and the room was empty with the window standing open. The bed had been pushed away from the wall and Patrick testified there was blood everywhere. An interior bedroom lock engages from inside the room. Patrick wasn't locked in that room. He was locked out of it. Anybody inside could have opened that window and walked out any second. On the claim that somebody staged her injuries, the two sides in that courtroom disagree with each other, and neither one of them points at her husband. The defense says she cut herself and went out that window trying to die. Prosecutors have suggested she faked it herself and the attempt afterwards. Nobody's pointing at Patrick other than Instagram and TikTok. The 911 call runs about 7 minutes without a break, and the jury heard all of it. It starts when he finds her on the lawn and ends in the basement, and he screams in it. Jurors fought back tears, and the judge called a recess. The judge also barred anyone from broadcasting the audio, so the people picking apart Patrick Clancy's word choices on that call have never heard it. Lindsay Clancy's DNA was on the exercise bands. Both sides agreed to that in court. But Trooper Jonathan O'Loughlin testified as that investigators pulled no usable fingerprints off the knife or the three bands. Comment sections have been running that line as proof somebody else handled those bands. Fingerprints and DNA are two different things. A fingerprint is the ridge pattern skin presses into a surface. DNA is material the body sheds, and it transfers by contact without leaving any pattern at all. O'Loughlin explained why prints fail. He called them very fragile. He said texture, weather, movement all destroy them. Rubber, exercise band stretch, and the whole family had been handling them for months. Patrick Clancy sued four defendants on behalf of his children's estates. He named Dr. Jennifer Tutts, nurse practitioner Rebecca Jolita, Astor Mental Health in South Shore. The suit alleges they over-medicated his wife and missed a psychiatric emergency that needed a hospital bed. If he did this, he would be also opening the door to depositions, discovery, all sorts of things that would eventually point at him if he did it. Oh, there's that little fact, too. Yeah, we don't... Lindsay Clancy filed her own suit and named 11 defendants, seven of them individual providers, plus McLean Hospital and Women and Infants Hospital of Rhode Island. Her filing says she did everything a mother in her situation could do. She scheduled her own appointments, went to emergency rooms, called crisis lines, and admitted herself to hospitals. Patrick's complaint quotes her own medical records. They describe a compelling male voice that she could not recognize, telling her this was her last chance and that she should die. She'd been married to Patrick Clancy for years. She would know his voice, and the voice in her records was telling her to kill herself. She testified that no provider ever told him to keep the children away from her mother. He told police that Lindsay had the worst side effects possible from the medication she was given. He said he wasn't married to a monster. But he got married. 3 years later, he got married. Not 3 months, not 4 months, as many of the internet rumors would like you to believe. 3 years. It's a lot of time. Well, that's too quick. Really? What did you tell me? Tell me, anyone who's saying, well, that's too quick, tell me personally what you did when your spouse took the lives of your three children. How long did you wait? Oh, you've never been in that situation or anything remotely like it? Yet you feel you have the authority to judge his choices to get married 3 years later? That was too quick for you? I'm sorry he didn't reach out to Jill in Ohio to figure out if you know, it would be okay with him to get remarried, or that would upset you on TikTok. He married Dr. Rachel Dennis in April of 26, more than 3 years after his children died. But again, Jill in Ohio, let me know. Is it too quick? Just checking. Let us know in the comments. Let us know what you would do or how you did it, since everyone has the expertise in what is too quick and too slow and just right. Patrick had suffered one of the worst tragedies a person can suffer. And he was trying hard to move on. Should he just sit there and wallow in the sorrow and the hell of that till eternity? Should he post, hey, TikTok, hey, Instagram, what do you bitches think I should do? Get remarried. What do you guys think? Let me check in with you first. I know none of you lost your family to postpartum psychosis, but what do you think? You tell me. Would that have been more appropriate? On the first anniversary of the deaths, Patrick Clancy drove home from his children's memorial service and called his wife from the car. He asked her the questions the internet says he spent 3 years running from. Did you plan this? Is this why you sent me out? She told him no. It has been like a snap of the fingers. He asked why she had locked up and how long the dinner run would take, or looked up how long the dinner run would take. She said she'd been worried about him hitting rush hour traffic. Then he asked whether she had Googled ways to kill. She said yes for herself because she had been in that state for 2 months. And he sat down with a reporter from The New Yorker and repeated all of it, including the answer that hurt her. In that same interview, he said what he would change. A few weeks earlier, he would have been reluctant to leave her alone, but that day he seemed like a good one. If he could go back, he'd have called McLean Hospital and told them to take her away and lock the door. Patrick Clancy's lawsuit and Lindsay Clancy's defense make the same argument. And he made it first. Days after he buried three children, he asked strangers on a fundraising page to forgive her the way he had. For the theory to hold, he did all that while sitting on the truth, and Lindsay Clancy paralyzed and facing three counts of first-degree murder is taking it in silence to somehow protect him. So Social media did reach this trial. Lindsay Clancy's defense moved to call Emily Thorndike, a former social worker whose viral video characterized a psychiatric hospital's care, to the witness stand at the 11th hour. Her own lawyers are the ones who went looking for that witness. Three of the providers who treated Lindsay Clancy have now testified in the filings, name all three as defendants. Dr. Jennifer Tubbs spent the 10th day on the trial under cross-examination, defending the care she gave. Julie Paul took the stand after her. Patrick Clancy drove to Kingston that evening to buy stool softener for his five-year-old daughter. He came home, called his wife's phone, got the answer. Got no answer. Went up the stairs. Cora Dawson and Callan were all found in the basement. That's the hell that Patrick Clancy lived through. And now some assholes on the internet feel they have the authority to victimize him again. For fun. You know, it's a fun theory. It's a mystery. Ooh, it's a conspiracy. Now it's someone's life. Someone's life, someone's hell, unimaginable hell that they went through. And it's a good thing Julie in Kentucky has an opinion to help stir that up and pour a little more gasoline on that fire. While pissing on the graves of those three children. That's what you're doing when you're going down that road. You are desecrating the graves and the memories of those three children by going after the one surviving member of that family that has done something unimaginable, found forgiveness, and has found a way to move on with his life and raise awareness for this horrible thing called postpartum psychosis. What exactly are you doing, Stephanie, in Cincinnati, when you're retweeting that shit? Your thoughts in the comments section. I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's the Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.